Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Did the ideas of Deuteronomy influence the prophecies of Ezekiel? Jason Giles says yes. His recent monograph argues that Deuteronomy's ideas influenced Ezekiel's response to the crisis surrounding the fall of Jerusalem and the Babylonian exile in significant ways, shaping how he saw Israel's past history of rebellion against Yahweh, present situation of divine judgment, and future hope of restoration. Tune in as we speak with Jason Giles about his recent book, Ezekiel and the World of Deuteronomy. You're listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Michael Morales. Jason Giles serves as Dean of Program Development and Innovation, as well as Affiliate Professor of Old Testament at Northern Seminary in Illinois. Jason, welcome to New Books in Biblical Studies.
Pleasure to be with you. Thanks, Michael.
So Jason, tell us more about yourself and how you came to be interested in the book of Ezekiel.
Sure, yeah. Well, I started studying the Bible in a university context at the University of Wisconsin. So my early teachers were people like Michael Fox and Cynthia Miller, among others. And actually, my first Hebrew teacher was Michael Lyons, who actually was working on Ezekiel at the time at the University of Wisconsin. So he had gone before me, so to speak, and written a book on Ezekiel's use of Leviticus or the Holiness Code. And so I didn't think much about that topic at the time, but it is kind of funny now in retrospect that he was actually my first Hebrew teacher, because now I've gone on to do work in a somewhat related area, which is our topic for today. And so, so studied Hebrew there in university context, did my bachelor's and master's degree in Hebrew Bible and Jewish studies. From there, I went to Wheaton College Graduate School to do my PhD in Old Testament and studied with Dan Block. And so that's really where this work began. My topic there for the dissertation was Ezekiel's use of Deuteronomy, or conversely, the flip of that would be Deuteronomy's influence on Ezekiel. And so that's really where the book that we're going to be talking about today came out of, is that dissertation work. And so that topic was uniquely suited both to my background, because I went on to do a full year class of the Hebrew text of Ezekiel with Michael Fox in my master's program. So I went into my PhD study with a pretty significant background in Ezekiel and the Hebrew text thereof. And then when I got to Wheaton, it was a good fit because Daniel Block is one of the foremost Ezekiel scholars, and he also had interest in Deuteronomy too. So it seemed like a pretty natural topic to study Ezekiel's use of Deuteronomy.
Your book is called Ezekiel in the World of Deuteronomy. Let's begin more broadly. Would you give our listeners a basic orientation to Ezekiel's content and historical context?
Well, Ezekiel lived at one of the most significant moments in Israel's history, which is the Babylonian exile, before, during, and after. So I think that that's the reference point historically and theologically to think about Ezekiel. And so he's a prophet in the years leading up to the fall of Jerusalem. It's well known that he was exiled with a group before the fall of Jerusalem. So he's in exile when Jerusalem falls. And then here's the news of the fall of Jerusalem while he's there. And then, of course, there's the the post judgment moment as well as they're thinking about the future. So that's kind of the reference point that I would encourage people to think about for this book, which means then when you think about Ezekiel's message, you can kind of frame it that way, that in the years leading up to Ezekiel, he's announcing judgment is coming. And of course, with that accusation of Israel's wrongdoing. And then, of course, the fall of Jerusalem happens and the judgment thereof. And then thereafter, he's looking ahead like other prophets to the future and so some of the existential questions that they're dealing with about both themselves as God's people, as well as Yahweh's place among the gods and his supremacy among the nations, some of those kind of theodicy type questions as well. And thinking about, does God have a future for them? So that I think is a helpful framework to think about Ezekiel's message. So when he's calling out Israel for their wrongdoings, some of the big categories for that would be idolatry is a big one. And that's one of the topics in my book, as well as broadly holiness or cultic type offenses. And a lot of that is rooted in some of the holiness teaching of Leviticus. And that's part of what I work with as well. And then there's what you might just call social wrongs, social injustice, those sorts of things. So yeah, my work actually kind of fits into that context because Ezekiel is considered to be a priestly prophet. And what I was looking at is to what extent does Deuteronomy influence him as well?
Now then, your work relates specifically to Ezekiel's use of Deuteronomy's content or world ideas. Tell us about that.
Okay, where to start? So by arguing for Ezekiel's use of Deuteronomic language and ideas, and therefore Deuteronomy's influence on him, I'm not minimizing at all the priestly or holiness influence on Ezekiel. It need not be one or the other. What I'm trying to do is to bring into balance a bit more of those two things, or to acknowledge or elevate something that's in some cases been dismissed. In other words, there's been a lot of people who've said Ezekiel is such a priestly prophet, there's really no Deuteronomic influence at all. So that was really the key question that I was looking at in my work. So I would say that when you read the book, now this, I'm quoting another scholar, Paul Joyce here. He says that the Deuteronomic language is relatively muted. I agree with that. So I think in comparison, there's a lot more what you might call holiness language from Leviticus than there is Deuteronomic, and that's okay. So I'm not trying to minimize the fact that, yes, indeed, Ezekiel very much is a priestly prophet, but I'm also trying to show the Deuteronomic parts of it as well. So that's really the core thesis of the book, and I can kind of get into some of the arguments for it. Maybe one other piece of context is important for this. Scholars widely acknowledge that Ezekiel uses literary sources, both Israelite traditions, also international, or you know, from other parts of the ancient Near East as well. And there's a pretty much agreement now that because of Ezekiel's priestly training, that he was a highly educated person, that he was probably also educated as a scribe and therefore familiar with literary traditions. And that's part of the context, is that when we come to ask this question about could Ezekiel have been influenced by Deuteronomy, there's reason to believe that he could be familiar with Deuteronomy like he's familiar with other biblical and non-biblical traditions. One other thing by way of preface, which is to say, and maybe this is sort of one of the contributions of my work now, is to think about what it means to quote unquote use literary sources in an oral world. Okay. So I think in the past, some scholars have assumed that if a biblical prophet or writer is using or quoting or alluding to a previous text, that it might be happening because they have the text in front of them. Right, that it's a very visual process, that they've got their scroll, and they've got the scroll of say parts of the Holiness Code in front of them, and it's visual. So this is, I did not, of course, I'm not the one personally to think this through, but I am drawing on some leading people like David Carr and Carol Vandertorn, who have pointed out that literary use in this oral world is more from memory, actually. So that's part of one of the unique contributions here is that I'm framing this Ezekiel's use of Deuteronomy or its language or ideas as really one that can be done from his knowledge of biblical texts, either from having heard them or having memorized parts of biblical texts, and not so much as a visual process.
How about giving us something of a summary of the chapters of your book?
The chapters cover a variety of topics. The first major chapter is on idolatry, and I'm arguing there that a couple of things. Number one, idolatry for Ezekiel was the key major offense for Israel that led to judgment. I mean, that's a core argument that I'm drawing from others on that. And that secondly, his language for idolatry is almost exclusively Deuteronomic. Now, why would that be? Well, in part, Leviticus and the Holiness Code doesn't say a lot about idolatry. It doesn't feature prominently. It's there a couple times. And incidentally, in those couple times, he does occasionally use its language. But idolatry is a much bigger deal in Deuteronomy than it is in Leviticus. And what we see then is that much of Ezekiel's language and conception of idolatry shows a preference for Deuteronomic language, and he's drawing on a lot of those kinds of things, both vocabulary and even conceptually as well. So that's really the first major content chapter. The second one is about Ezekiel's use of a particular text. So this is his use of Deuteronomy 32. Now, this chapter I published as an article in JBL before the whole work came out as a book, so people can find it there as well. But the core idea is that Ezekiel 16 is a prophetic transformation of Deuteronomy 32, the Song of Moses. Now, this is maybe one of the chapters that I'll spend a little bit more time on, so I'll maybe take a few moments here to get into this one. So Ezekiel 16 is a prophetic indictment against Israel's sins broadly, but idolatry in particular. But it's kind of a historical review, right? It goes back over Israel's history. It's metaphorical. So it's a well-known chapter that describes Israel's religious sins in metaphorical terms, namely as adultery and kind of sexual sins as well. So whereas chapter 20 also is a historical review, that's not per se metaphorical, whereas Ezekiel 16 is very metaphorical. Deuteronomy 32 has similarities. Now there's differences and similarities, right? So of course, Deuteronomy 32, if Ezekiel is drawing upon it, is not, it doesn't have the prostitution or adultery type metaphor in it. And so that's kind of granted in my article/chapter right from the beginning. But nevertheless, the narrative structure and themes are there. And then on top of that, and this is kind of really the core of the argument, it's not just that these two chapters or passages are similar at a structural thematic level. That is true. But also at similar points in the story, they even have shared vocabulary or shared rare concepts, which are hard to be coincidental. So that's really the core argument. And maybe, again, since I'm spending a little more time on this one, I could give you kind of a quick synopsis of what these parallel stories are, if you will, with some of the shared vocabulary. So, of course, when I give this little synopsis, the listeners will have to find this chapter or that article to see this in detail. Certainly, I can't do justice to the arguments and the counterarguments and those sorts of things that I address, but maybe this will whet their appetite nonetheless. All right, so both chapters, passages, start with Yahweh's discovery of Israel in some sort of destitute situation. Okay. Language is a little bit different, but I think that this is a pretty unique concept, right? Yahweh's relationship with Israel starts, metaphorically speaking, with a discovery of her. And then secondly, when after Yahweh saves Israel, that he cares lavishly for her. Now, here's a couple points where you get, at this point in the story, some shared language and some shared vocabulary. So this is where I think the argument becomes more persuasive, because this is the part that is hard to be coincidental. So first, in Deuteronomy 32, again, at this very point in the story, Yahweh's care of Israel is described as like an eagle spreading its wings. And in Ezekiel, God says, I will spread my garment over you. Now, okay, when you hear that in English, you didn't catch it, maybe, perhaps, unless you know Hebrew. But the Hebrew language is the same. Paras, to spread, and kanaf, which is wing or garment. Okay, so in translation, you might not see the one place says wing and the place says garment, but it's the same in Hebrew. And so the next thing is that God takes care of Israel by giving honey and oil. And so those are two more key words there at that point. The third part of the story is about Israel then, because of Yahweh's care, prospering. The fourth is that in both stories, Israel forsakes God, and specifically idolatry is mentioned. And here's another linguistic similarity at this point in the story. In both cases, the idolatry is described as Israel serving or worshiping Zarim, which is a pretty unique use of that word for idolatry. The next piece is that Israel forgets its origins. So in Deuteronomy, you forgot the God who gave you birth. In Ezekiel, you didn't remember the days of your youth when you were naked and bare, etc. So that forgetting is, of course, a pretty distinct concept. And then there's three more parts here. The next part is that Israel angers Yahweh. And so the same word, ka'as, is used as well. Second to last, that Israel is punished. And then finally, Israel is restored at the end of both of these stories. And again, another linguistic similarity, the verb kipper, to atone. In Deuteronomy, Yahweh atones for his people's land. In Ezekiel, Yahweh atones for his people's sins. But that word is pretty unique in restoration type oracles. So that's kind of the big synopsis of these two stories. Again, a lot of similarities. There are differences too, but if you take a closer look at the argumentation, you'll see how I address some of these things, both maybe some of the counter arguments, as well as whether how likely it would have been that Ezekiel might have known a passage like this. Scholars are pretty much on a consensus that Deuteronomy 32 is an early Hebrew poem, like the Song of the Sea, for example. And so, and for that matter, probably well known in Israel, because other biblical writers seem to draw from it as well. So I address some of those kinds of contextual things. And if true, then it would mean that Ezekiel is taking this chapter, I'm sorry, passage from Deuteronomy. Although, okay, sorry to get into the weeds here, but maybe I don't want to use that language, because it could have been known not simply as just part of Deuteronomy, right? I mean, so I want to qualify that, but it's a well-known passage, arguably known to Israel's audience. And what Ezekiel is doing then is he's transforming it, right? This is a prophetic transformation to indict Israel in a new time, and maybe even say that the judgment and the story there in the Song of Moses is actually now here in Ezekiel's time being actualized, and that judgment is now coming about in their day. And yet, lastly, maybe still God will be faithful to them and restore them in the future.
That's a great chapter on Deuteronomy 32. Tell us a little bit now about the other ground you cover in the book.
The next chapter is about Israel's history, primarily looking at chapter 20, which was another historical review in the book of Ezekiel, not metaphorical in quite the same way as Ezekiel 16 is. People have noticed before that Ezekiel uses a lot of Deuteronomic language in chapter 20. And so I kind of assemble some of the work and observations that people have made, as well as make some new ones of my own. And so in some ways, this is kind of the most now comprehensive treatment of that topic. So it's use of Deuteronomic language, yes. But then there's a couple instances where I make an argument, not just that he's using Deuteronomic language, but might actually be thinking of or referring to a specific passage of Deuteronomy. So I do a little bit of that as well. I address some of the arguments that people think that have said that Ezekiel's using Deuteronomy's language in a polemical kind of way, that he's actually, although he's using it, he's not endorsing it. So I address some of those counter arguments as well. Now could be a good time to just mention one thing, and this is sort of a methodological consideration, but when I see similar language, shared language, if you will, and others, there's always the question of, well, how do you categorize it and how do you explain? So is it intentional or is it not, is the big question. Some scholars have used different words like quotation and allusion to talk about these kinds of things. So let me just say a quick word about how I handle that here. And maybe also this is one of the contributions of my work. So I do not get hung up on deciding whether something is a quotation or allusion or an allusion. I don't think it's actually the most important question. You could get into defining what those two words mean. And I think the key difference is how verbatim is the shared language. So more verbatim was what would be more on the side of a quotation, but less verbatim or more kind of paraphrastic shared language might be more on the side of allusion. And I agree with that conception. But the reality is that there's not a clear line between those two things. And so there's kind of a spectrum, if you will. And so now I do think broadly, most of what we're seeing in Ezekiel and the whole Hebrew Bible for that matter is allusion, more so than quotation. But I don't get hung up on whether every instance of shared language here that I might see between Ezekiel and Deuteronomy or some other prophetic, or I guess Leviticus for that matter too, I'm not hung up on what on figuring out or calling it one or the other, right? Is it quotation or allusion? To me, they're both literary reference. And I'm content to just say that's literary reference. So I instead start with more basic categories. And I'll just mention them here quickly. So my basic categories would be, number one, you see shared language, it could be coincidence. So that's number one. If it's not a distinctive word, if there's not a lot of kind of shared language, and then it's probably not super meaningful. So that's the first one. It could be coincidence. The second one is what I call indirect usage, which basically just means, for Ezekiel, for example, he's using a word that we think is Deuteronomic, but it could just be from what I call common parlance, right? Like it's out there. It's among the religious vocabulary of Israel's contemporaries. And so he may not be drawing specifically from a text or a passage as such, but it's an indirect usage. But in this case, though, I'm assuming for my work that it is distinctively Deuteronomic. In other words, when people would be hearing it in the world, they would associate it perhaps with Deuteronomy more so than some other biblical tradition potentially. So what that means then is that even if it's indirect usage, it's not literary reference, if you will, but it could reflect his Deuteronomy's influence on it, right? The degree to which he uses that kind of language. Okay, number three and number four. Number three, and they're similar. Number three is literary borrowing. Number four is literary dependence. So literary borrowing basically means we have reason to believe that Ezekiel may know of a particular text and is borrowing his language from that. The fourth is very similar, but More specifically, he's not just borrowing it, but he actually wants to refer the reader to it implicitly. That's not a, as Moses said, or as Deuteronomy said, it's not that explicit. But there are ways to kind of, through allusion, covertly make the reader or listener think of the text that's being referred to. So if we can kind of maintain that distinction. Literary borrowing and literary reference are similar, both based on Ezekiel's use of a text, but one where he is referring the reader and wanting them to think of it, and another one where he's not. So that's chapter two. People can kind of look at the method work that I do on that, and hopefully it's helpful for thinking about Ezekiel's use of Deuteronomy, and for that matter, conceptually for others to think about interbiblical allusion and reference as well. Okay, maybe I'll just briefly mention the last two chapters, because I think we've covered most of the things here. Again, a lot of the detailed argumentation and some of the examples you'll have to see in the book, and I won't be able to get into them here. I'll just lastly add, the last two chapters are about exile and restoration. And more specifically, I key in on the metaphors or words of scattering and gathering. So those are kind of two main metaphors or vocabulary words for Ezekiel. And what I argue is that Ezekiel in both cases is primarily using Deuteronomy's language and concepts and conception of both exile and restoration. And so you'd have to go into the details to see there. He does in one instance use a word, Leviticus's word for exile. But what he's actually doing, I think, is doing some combining. Michael Lyons, who I mentioned before in his work on the Ezekiel's Holiness Code, pointed out what he calls some like techniques of literary appropriation. And I see Ezekiel doing similar things as well. And I think what he's doing in the case of exile is he's actually combining some language from Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And something similar with his view of restoration or gathering as well, that there's consistent ways that he does it, and that and they're very formulaic. That's one of the distinguishing features of Ezekiel's language for exile and restoration compared to some other prophets, is that he has kind of a formulaic way of talking about it, and that helps you kind of pinpoint some of the literary appropriation work that he's doing and how he connects it back to Leviticus and Deuteronomy for them. So those are some of the major chapters. I feel like I, of course, not gotten into all of the details and haven't attempted to, you know, make a case, so to speak, for some of the core arguments because of time reasons, and would have to get into all sorts of details that I don't plan to here. But those are some of the core ideas of the book.
Jason, what's on the horizon for you in terms of research and writing? Any further work on Ezekiel or Deuteronomy?
I think the simple answer there is maybe. It's not on my immediate horizon, so I've got some other things that I'm working on and planning to work on that are more kind of macro biblical theology sorts of stuff that kind of tie together the whole Hebrew Bible, and for that matter, the whole Christian scriptures as well. And so, yeah, I think I might return to one of these two books in the future, but it's not. Those other things have higher priority for me.
Well, Jason, it's been great hearing about your work. All the best on your future endeavors, and thank you for being with us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me, Michael.
Friends, you've been listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.